Okay, my guest tonight is a computer scientist by profession. He's Dr. Jacques Vallée. He was born in France, where he was trained in astrophysics. He was awarded the Jules Verne Prize for his first novel in French entitled Subspace and written at age 19. He moved to the United States, receiving his Ph.D. in computer science in 1967 from Northwestern University, where he was a close associate of the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek. He eventually published three more novels in French. Fastwalker is his first work of fiction in the English language. The author of many scientific articles and of three books about high technology, Dr. Vallée first became interested in the subject of UFOs when he witnessed the destruction of tracking tapes of unknown objects at a Paris observatory. He was the first to compile a computer catalog of UFO landings, and he was also the first to document the striking similarities between descriptions of encounters in contemporary abductions and medieval reports of elves, fairies, and demons in folklore. His research into the phenomena has taken him to many places in the United States and to many countries around the world, from France to Scotland and from Australia to Russia and Brazil. His unique approach was crystallized when he served as the real-life model for the character of the French scientist played by François Truffaut in Steven Spielberg's classic film Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Now, his books have been translated into all the major languages and represent millions of copies in print. His most recent work, Forbidden Science, was published in hardcover in 1992 by North Atlantic Books. Again, it is my pleasure to welcome to the program Dr. Jacques Vallée. Good evening, Jacques.
Good evening, Michael. How are you?
Very good, and thank you for being on the program tonight.
My pleasure.
We're talking tonight about the book Fastwalker, which is a novel in collaboration with Tracy Tormé. Tell us real quick, in a couple of words, what the book is about.
Well, it's a novel. First, it's fiction, so I hope people don't take it too seriously. I wrote it for fun. I also wrote it because there are things you can say in a novel that you cannot say in a non-fiction book. And I wanted to try to come up with a complete scenario of what might happen if there was a cover-up, if there was a real cover-up, if there was a secret organization gathering data about UFOs. As you know, there have been many hints and speculation in the UFO community, in the UFO research community about such
right.
a group.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen if there was such a group? What would they think about? Who would they be? How would they interact with the rest of government? And more importantly, what would happen if they got their hands on the real thing?
Okay. And Jacques, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. I'm been an admirer of your research for a long time, your books and everything. And it's really a pleasure to have you on the program tonight.
Thank you.
Take us through a little tour of Fastwalker, you know, the characters, the main characters, and give us a little bit about them.
Well, what I tried to do, I had written this book first in French about 10 years ago. It was actually published under the title À l'Intel in Paris in 1986. And À l'Intel stands for the Alien Intelligence Agency. Most people don't know that there is an alien intelligence agency, but there is in my novel, and it's looking for UFO data, and it's in fact trying to get their hands on a UFO and then trying to do all kinds of evil things with it. What I've tried to do in working again on the novel for the English edition is bringing in characters who would represent the different viewpoints of the UFO community and viewpoints of the media and the public and the military and so on. So there are a number of characters, some of which are ominous and scary, and others are frankly funny, and others are sympathetic, I think, that get involved and they get abducted, and they get confronted with the mystery.
I must tell you that if you wrote parts of this, or at least the first publication in French 10 years ago, this is a very timely piece of work, you know?
It was a little bit ahead of its time when it came out.
I have to agree. You've got a character in here, the manipulator, General Bushnell. The investigator is Peter Keller, and the victim is Rachel Rand. And as Jacques has said, this has got a little bit of everything as far as the character makeup goes. Jacques, what is the underlying theme of the book? I mean, now, to set that up, I guess we have to talk a little bit about some of your background and where you've been in the UFO research arena. You worked with Dr. Hynek years ago, and I must say that, you know, the credentials are definitely there. And, you know, what have you seen over the years?
when I first heard of UFOs, I was a teenager in France, a science student. I wanted to be an astronomer. I thought there couldn't be UFOs because if there were, astronomers would see them and astronomers would tell us. And I had seen something when I was 15 and I sort of dismissed it because I thought it must be, I convinced myself it must be some sort of prototype, even though I realize now it couldn't have been a prototype at the time. Then what really awakened my interest is when I was working at Paris Observatory, we were tracking satellites. And we started tracking something that was not a satellite and was may have been in orbit for a short time. And we destroyed the tape. I mean, the man in charge of the project confiscated the tape and erased it. And that's really what awakened my interest because evidently professional astronomers were seeing things that they were not willing to discuss publicly. They were not even willing to discuss them with their colleagues. And those things may have been explainable, but that really restarted my reopened the question for me. So I started assembling data. I found that there was a lot of data. There was a lot of good data, well-documented, unexplained data from scientists and technically trained people and reliable observers. And then when I came to the U.S. and I had the privilege of working with Dr. Hynek, I found that there was equally good data, of course, in the United States. And at the time, I think all of us were a little bit arrogant. We thought that this subject had never been looked at seriously by scientists, that if we assembled a team to look at it, we could quickly come to demonstrate to the scientific community that there was a real phenomenon and, of course, that we would solve it. Maybe not us, but the scientific community as a whole would solve it because the tools of science, which are very powerful, had never been applied to this problem. Well, here we are, you know, many years later.
Right.
You and I know that we have not solved the problem.
It continues to deepen.
It's a much more complex problem than anybody thought.
Now, in the book, there's a part in here about the notion that in my own research, I have gone back into the early 50s. The history of this phenomenon is very interesting to me personally. And we recently had Al Chop on the program, who, as you probably know, is the Pentagon spokesperson in 52 when they had the overflight in Washington, D.C.
Yes, he's prominently discussed in Don Quixote's books.
Right. Now, the question I have is, and there's something in the book here about this, and I'd like to kind of develop this a little bit. The notion is that there was some indication from Ruppelt's writings that there were certain people that he couldn't mention. He never mentioned their names in the manuscripts or anything. But he said there were certain people that seemed to know or predicted, like, for example, the Washington thing in 52, July of 52. He had talked to a mysterious intelligence type who almost predicted to the day when this was going to happen, and he thought it was very unusual. Now, in the book, there's a discussion in there about the idea that there is something else going on that might be mind control, and that it might have started in 53 with the Robertson panel or even before that. Can you develop that for me a little bit?
Well, a lot of that is a matter of record. I mean, I didn't make that up.
Right.
Before Congress, there has been a lot of testimony over the years about the mind control projects of the 60s, which really started in the 50s. And when you look at it carefully, and a number of people have looked at this, certainly not the only one, Martin Cannon has looked at this,
right.
And others have called attention to this, there is an interrelationship which is very uncomfortable between some of the people who have been officially involved in UFO research and some of the people who have been involved in psychological warfare or mind control.
Mm-hmm.
A good example of that is the board of NICAP. NICAP under Don Quixote had on its board not only the former director of the CIA, which may or may not be relevant, but had three of the people who were the engineers or the basic experts on psychological warfare in the Pentagon. Now, that should have alerted. At the time, of course, nobody thought very much of it. I think in retrospect, it does look fairly ominous. I mean, why were they there? And what impact could they have had? Were they using NICAP? Were they just curious about UFOs? And now, apart from this, I mean, all of us who have lectured about UFOs or written books and so on have been approached by people who have said, I know it was a common experience for Hynek, and it has been an experience for me. People would come to you after a lecture and say, look, I was a pilot, I was a radar operator, I was in the Strategic Air Command, or I was in the Navy, and we saw this, and we tracked it, and we had pictures, and strange people came to us and flashed their credentials to my commanding officer, demanded the pictures, and left, and took the evidence with them.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody has been collecting data all those years. I have absolutely no question about that. I think Hynek had no question that there was such data collection. Everybody has been aware of it. Does that mean that somebody has the answer? Well, not necessarily. Again, we have to be careful not to jump to conclusions too quickly. It could be, and I play with that in the novel, that these people have a lot of data, but they still don't know what it is that they are really controlling.
Now, you were the person that introduced the Pentacle memorandum.
Yes.
And it was it was covered in your previous book, Forbidden Science. Why was that memo so important?
Well, as you know, there is disagreement about how relevant it is among my readers and among the research community. It was certainly very important to me and to Alan Hynek. I discovered it at one time. I went through and reorganized the files of Alan Hynek in the late 60s. The files were a mess because he was traveling all the time and people kept giving him data and he had no place to put it. So we decided we'd better put some order into this. And in the files, there was a very thick historical file, and in that historical file was that memo. The memo was stamped secret, which is why I never said anything about it for 25 years. The memo originated with the time of the Robertson panel, which, as you know, was a turning point in the official history of the problem. The
right.
Robertson panel was a panel of the leading scientists in the country, very highly respected academics, researchers, directors of laboratories, and so on, all of them with top secret clearances. They were briefed by the Air Force on the UFO problem, dismissed it in a couple of days after reviewing the best evidence of the time, and said there was no reason for science to become involved, but that UFO groups should be watched and should be monitored, which meant infiltrated. Well, this memo had been written by the people who were behind that meeting. They were with a research institute. They were working for the CIA. Turns out that the CIA was the one that had convened the panel, not the Air Force. The Air Force was essentially a cover for the panel. And the letter said that, hey, we have data that should not be discussed with these scientists, and which may or may not be ominous. I think it's ominous because I think when you call together a panel of scientists of that caliber, they should have access to all the data. Here were the people who had compiled the first computerized catalog of
right.
American data. They were saying, don't get this panel together, and if you do, let's discuss what can and cannot be discussed with the members of the panel. And that, when I read that, it sent a chill through me. I discussed it often with Alan Hynek. Alan Hynek did contact the people who had written the memo, went back to them with his notes. They told him not to talk about it.
Okay.
They snatched his notes and
set him
his notes
and set him home
to talk about it.
Yeah. We've got a car phone calling in from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Jacques, we're going to take that call now. Patrick is listening on KHTL in Albuquerque. Good evening, Patrick.
Good evening. Dr. Vallée, it is such an honor to hear you. I've been wanting to hear your thoughts. I've read some of your earlier works, and it's really a pleasure to hear you tonight.
Thank you.
Listen, I wanted to ask a question, and I'm excited to read your novel, but there was one question in particular I had from an earlier work of yours, and I believe it was from Dimension. You were talking about the fact that there were statistically so many UFO sightings that it was improbable that all of these sightings were coming from other worlds, that in essence, if I remember correctly, what you were saying is that this was some sort of a control system that was being put in place on us, not only the amount of sightings, but also the fact that the sightings have changed so much technologically over the years. And I just wondered if you would talk about about that theory and about your ideas on that, and give me some idea of what you were meaning with that.
That's a good question, Patrick, and thank you for your call, and we'll have Jacques answer that.
Thanks.
When we started many years ago compiling data about UFO sightings and so on, there were only a few hundreds or at most a few thousand really puzzling cases. And you could make a case that this indicated an extraterrestrial explanation. And in fact, that's what I advocated in the 60s and the 70s. The problem is that we kept getting more and more data, and the data we have now is in the dozens of thousands of cases worldwide, and yet we know that we only get one report in 10, maybe, and even less in the third world, for example, where there are fewer newspapers and fewer radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that say about what's going on? It must be a phenomenon which is, if you take the assumption, and again here, this is you have to qualify, as always in statistics, what the assumptions are. If you assume, as most UFO believers do, that we're being visited by aliens doing a survey of our world with vehicles that are essentially spacecraft, how do we reconcile that with a very enormous number of landings, an enormous number of abductions, with the technology we have today, with a fairly small spacecraft in orbit around a planet, if there was a planet that was emitting radio and television and all the communication that the Earth does, we would know everything we need to know about these people in an unobtrusive way. We might land a few times to get samples, but we wouldn't need to get samples every night from hundreds of people.
Right.
That wouldn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we were doing a biological experiment, we see our way clear today to developing cloning techniques or developing techniques that would enable us to achieve all those goals in a very unobtrusive way. So that theory, we need a better theory.
Now, when you're talking about this kind of stuff, when you talk about control mechanisms and that type of thing, I know you advanced an interesting theory in Messengers of Deception about the idea that there might be some terrestrial-based control devices or that type of thing. Is there? I know you're not saying that the UFO phenomena is not real. There's something going on there. But
I definitely think there is a phenomenon and that there is a form of consciousness that's not human that's responsible for it. Whether it's extraterrestrial or not, I can't tell.
But you think also that there's another subgroup to this. I mean, it is very
yes.
complex. This is a very complex problem.
I think the phenomenon has been used as a shield to cover some very terrestrial mind control experiments. I think Bentwaters' case in England is an example of that. I think we have technologies that are used to confuse people. I think it's logical that those technologies would be developed. They are well within the state of the art. And I think that the UFO theme has been used deliberately as a cover. Look, Jim Oberg, who is a skeptic, he's a debunker, has proven to me that some of the UFOs that were seen in the Soviet Union, in the old Soviet Union,
right.
I had reported from the 60s, were in fact stories that were planted by the KGB to explain a space shot or a series of space shots that they were doing that were essentially illegal, that violated the SALT treaty. I think in this case he is right and I'm wrong. I've accepted his explanation. Now, that's a game that everybody can play. The Russians were planting UFO stories so that we wouldn't look too closely at what was going on in the sky on those particular nights.
Given that type of scenario, Jacques, wouldn't you say, I would say myself, that this is a very this would be very difficult to unsnarl. How do you go, I mean, how would you go about detecting?
Well, I have a simple way of doing that, Michael.
Uh-huh.
I only investigate cases that are reported to me directly, usually by my readers, usually by people who don't want any publicity. Very often those are ongoing cases where these people trust me and they send me the information and they don't want it reported anywhere. Increasingly, and that's very distressing, by the way, because the the field has become so sensational, you know, with stories of fake autopsies and the Gumbrace case and the MJ-12 and all of that, that witnesses, the best reports, the best cases are not reported. And the witnesses want to stay, want the information to remain confidential. Scientists are not, in most cases, getting the best reports. And what you have in the media is essentially noise, and that's a problem.
And that is a problem because it's difficult to weed through all of that and try to get to the bottom of what's going on.
Yes.
Jacques, on this whole notion of, let's go into a hypothetical mode here. Let's say that there has been, as you suggested in the book here, in the novel, that there has been not necessarily, I was referring to the conversation between Professor Byrne and Peter Keller, that the whole thing is not about whether or not there's aliens here or something like that, but more to the point, the rogue element that is possibly at work here. I mean, this is a very good possibility, I must admit. But what would be the implications of that?
Well, if there is a technology that can do what the witnesses, the UFO witnesses, are describing, it is not just an incremental technology over space rockets that we have now.
Right.
It's a revolutionary discovery.
Would they have maybe keyed in on the idea that this kind of thing, the response they were getting from the public, this would have been attractive to maybe people who might want to manipulate masses?
Yes. And we know that over the years, several aerospace companies have had covert or secret or at least private confidential research teams working on the UFO problem, and that they've used the UFO organizations, the open UFO research organizations, as a way of gathering data, as well as doing their own data secretly. The problem is, and that's a problem I try to pose in Fast Walker, these people were space cadets, if you want. I don't mean that in a pejorative
way. No, I know.
There's nothing wrong with them. Many of my best friends are space cadets. But they were approaching it from the point of view of extrapolating today's science. The problem is that we're faced with, I think, with something which is much more ominous and awesome and has aspects that quickly take us beyond science as we know it today. And that's where the interesting challenge, I think, is. How do we jump to that? Suppose we found one of those things. Suppose we have found one of those things. Then what? It may very well be that if you gave your Pentium to the best physicist of the 1920s, what could he do with it? What conclusion would he arrive at as he analyzed it? You know, there was nothing he could do with it. On the other hand, if we have biological samples, then I would think that would have to be a revolution. Because in biology,
sure,
we have only one data point, and that's Earth biology.
Right.
If all of a sudden we have, excepting for the fact that we do have organic data from space now increasingly, mm-hmm, but we don't have a biological entity from space. If all of a sudden we did, that would be a revolution.
Do you think that the mind is the mindset of the government? I mean, Al Chop said that the mindset of the people in the Pentagon at that time, and Ruppelt and all these other guys say that too, that they really did think that it was interplanetary, but they were waiting for an invasion, but it never came. And I think that, you know, we're presented with a lot of different things that are going on here, that really kind of leave things up in the air. But yet, I can see that, you know, my belief is that it did take a departure, it did take a turning point in 1953 with the Robertson panel. I think there's a lot of policy, public policy, that came out of that panel, and I think we're seeing the effects of it today because I think that has helped advance various sects and cults.
Well, I think that's why the Pentagon Memorandum is something that we should ponder seriously, because in part of that memorandum, these people were saying the reason they didn't want that panel to be set up wasn't that they were this is really covering up. They wanted to get more data, and they thought that one could get more data by running simulations. And what they were contemplating was taking an area in the United States, a big area, mm-hmm. where there was a high concentration of UFO sightings. Again, remember, they were looking at the data from the 50s, from the early 50s,
right.
51, 52, and then planting UFOs. In other words, having their own aerial phenomena displayed, and then analyzing the results, and doing that as a large-scale, covert military operation.
Now, how could they have done that? What technology was available to us back then to do something like that? I know that...
Oh, they could have used projectors, they could have used balloons, they could have used tethered devices. I mean, there were lots of flares, you know, there are indications that some of that was done as tests, simply to calibrate observers, including
sure.
military observers. I mean, when you have observers, you know, that's true in physics, it's true in astronomy, you need to calibrate them. Every observer has a personal equation that you need to take out of the data. That's true in science, but it's also true in the military. And they what they were proposing was something that was in fact very smart. They said we need to establish the profile of a UFO versus an IFO. And to do the only way to do that is to control everything in the air over a certain period and to create our own phenomena so that we know each time what was there. And then if there is something else, then we can analyze a profile. And I think it was a very smart idea. When you look afterwards at some of the UFO reports that are in the literature, you begin to wonder whether maybe somebody did that.
Right. Okay, I see what you're saying. Okay, I'm following that. Is it, you know, do you find, too, that this is becoming more, I guess, more of an intelligence problem than a science problem?
It's always been an intelligence problem, and it probably should be treated as an intelligence problem. I was taught a lesson once in the 70s, I mentioned that in the Messengers of Deception,
mm-hmm.
by someone who used to be in Army intelligence in World War II, and who told me he was retired, and he said, look, you're approaching this the wrong way. You're approaching this as a scientist. And I said, well, I don't know how else to approach it. And he said, well, in science, if you get 95% of the data, you're happy because you have 95% of the phenomenon. In intelligence, when you get 95% of the data, you have to assume that you have the wrong 95% because you have 95% that comes from the other side. What you need is the other 5%, but that 5% has a price that's much higher than the first 95%.
Right.
And that's what you have to go out and get. And I've never forgotten that lesson. I think it is both a scientific problem and an intelligence problem. And that's what I've tried to show in Fast Walker.
Okay. One quick question before we go to another break. Why did you drop out of the scene or semi-retire or whatever? Why did you take leave?
Well, I really didn't. I mean, I continue to do research, and I'm doing research now. I'm a scientist. I'm not really advocating a particular theory. I think theories are fine, and we need to come up with hypotheses and test them.
Right.
But most of what the UFO community does is really trying to convince, Congress or trying to
right.
lobby people about the reality of extraterrestrials, mainly. And I don't think that's useful. At least that's not what I can do. I don't think I can contribute to that. What I want to do is research, and those groups do very, very little research.
I agree. The state of ufology, the research is very poor.
So I think I can be more useful just following up on reports that people send me and trying to question my own assumptions.
Jacques, what's the future hold for you, and what are you going to be doing in the near future?
Well, it depends a little bit on what the reactions will be to Fast Walker. I think it's a book that may antagonize some people and may amuse others. It certainly doesn't take any prisoners, as you probably saw when you read it.
Uh-huh. I certainly enjoyed it.
I think that it's fun, but it also sends a signal that, hey, maybe it's time. Who is kidding here? I mean, it's time to put a lot of things on the table and question a lot of assumptions. the phenomenon is still with us after all those years. It's a very important phenomenon. Science should look at it. As you said before, the fact that the longer science refuses to look at it, the more we're going to see cults and sects and belief systems building up randomly around this, and that's very dangerous.
You bet it is. Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the program tonight, and we'll get this get word out on the copies of this book, and thank you again.
Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye. Dr. Jacques Vallée was my guest. We're talking about his book, Fast Walker, a novel. Okay, that's it for the time, and we'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Michael Corbin, telling you to keep your eyes on the skies.